regarding conflict with the Constitution. And the question is, and I'm having about a 3-minute answer or so, does the U.S. Patriot Act... Sure. Does the U.S. Patriot Act conflict with the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights? Is or isn't it normal in times of national threat and fears for our security that this conflict occur?
The Patriot Act does not conflict with the Bill of Rights, at least not any more than previous law ever did. When Professor Avery asks, when they're looking at trying to keep from having a bomb detonated on the subway in Boston, do they have a suspect, do they have a group, do they have probable cause? And he said, no. The fact is, according to the Patriot Law, the answer to that is yes, if they were able to get a judge to issue them the authority to go in. It's a simple fact that, now, you may believe that the judiciary is not doing its job, and there may be evidence in certain circumstances that I don't believe personally that there's evidence for that very much at all, if at all. But if there is evidence for the proposition that in specific instances or in a case of a specific judge, the judge isn't doing his or her job, that's the problem, not the fact that the police are attempting to keep a bomb from being detonated in a subway in Boston. It's really... I want to see people exercise their First Amendment rights, and I think that's a good thing, and I think forms like this are outstanding. But to allege that in New York City, the same NYPD whose brothers and sisters ran into the Trade Towers so they could die trying to save other people are now just in bad faith trying to pick on the legal advisors for legal protests because they don't want to bother checking for terrorism defies logic. It's not true. It's not true. The Patriot Act is contrary to the Bill of Rights, at least not if, according to its terms, the judiciary is doing its job. In most of the cases, the judiciary is doing its job. And in times of stress, certainly, there's more tendency to have a stress between freedoms and being free from searches. For instance, I remember myself when there were no metal detectors in schools or courts or airplanes. I personally remember when you'd go to the library and anytime you took out any book, you'd know exactly who took it out before you because all of their names were listed on the card right above yours. And there was no screaming about, my God, we're losing our right to privacy, because it was a more innocent time. And Professor Avery said, he doesn't necessarily say we should stop the searches on the airplanes and so forth. Well, that's because they make sense, sadly. And are we less free, perhaps? Perhaps. But they make sense, and they're not being administrated in bad faith in an effort to hurt people. They're necessary, again, sadly. Thank you.
Well, I think there are a number of provisions of the Patriot Act that violate the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, particularly with regard to protection of privacy. One would be Section 505, which allows for national security letters, which allows the government to get telephone records, internet records, financial records, consumer reports regarding individuals, without any judicial authorization, without the necessity of going to any court for an order. And in order to put that provision in the Patriot Act, quite apart from whatever Fourth Amendment protections we might have had against it, the Patriot Act had to amend, among other things, the Right to Financial Privacy Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Electronic Privacy Act, all of which had been enacted by previous Congresses precisely to avoid abuses. I think Section 214 and 216 of the Patriot Act, which provide much greater opportunities for the government to get pen registers and trap and trace devices that can discover from email traffic, they will say, well, we can't read the content of the email, but they read the subject line, and they know to whom the email is going, and that's an enormous amount of of information that's transmitted. And to do that, the agency has to only certify that it's relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. They can get a court order to get your educational records under Section 507 of the Act. I don't think that's in line with our concepts of privacy. Now, is it true that we've had problems in America before during time of crisis with the government trenching on people's constitutional rights? Of course it is. It was true during the Civil War. It was true during the First World War. It was true during the Second World War with the horrible incarceration of Japanese Americans in this country. Doesn't make it right. And the particular problem that we have with it now is that the president has announced a doctrine of unending war, of eternal war against terrorism. So there's no end in sight to the supposed present crisis. And that, I think, should trouble us very gravely.
The second question is regarding the use of the law. Have there been any legal cases brought to date involving the U.S. Patriot Act, related executive orders, legislation, or regulations passed in support of broader executive powers? Mr. Rebega?
There have indeed been a number of prosecutions, one of which was the one I earlier referenced about the folks trying to acquire Stinger missiles. There were the, I believe they were called the Lackawanna Six, who pled guilty to material support for a terrorist organization. At least one other group of folks who were essentially traveling back and forth to Pakistan and Afghanistan to engage in training, some of them prior to 9/11 and under the auspices of bin Laden. So, yeah, there have been a number of successful prosecutions. And by the way, the president didn't announce a doctrine of unending war. Unless I've missed it, the terrorists haven't given up. Unless I've missed it, as I say, with the greatest of respect, I believe the overwhelming majority of the country, along with 98 senators, probably, and the 80-something percent of the members of the House of Representatives, believe it's still a problem. One of the reasons we've got the luxury to say things like, and I believe I lost count, but I'm pretty sure there were more than 10 things in the top 10 list. There are about 20 that the professor mentioned. But the reason that the professor and certain others, and they've got a right to believe it, and I'm glad that they have the ability to express it, the reason they believe that terrorism isn't the top concern anymore is because it's been 3 years since any significant terrorist event in this country. And I don't think you could have found a single person in the United States of America on 9/12/01 who would have said we'd go 3 years without another such incident. I don't think you'd find too many people here and now today who'd say we'd go another year without such an incident. And ladies and gentlemen, one of the reasons we've gone 3 years without another incident like 9/11 is the Patriot Act being administrated in good faith and being watched over by judges.
It isn't the Patriot Act, it's law.
Well, opinions differ, but it's certainly, as I say, and in answer to the question, it's not law. There are people who are out there trying to acquire, among other things, Stinger missiles, chemical weapons, biological weapons, anthrax. There's been some prosecutions under the Patriot Act with regards to that. So it is a huge part of why there's been 3 years and no other significant terrorist act. I don't know if anyone would like to advocate the proposition we'll go another year with just luck. Thank you.
Well, I didn't realize this question was going to be asked, so I didn't come with a comprehensive list of the cases that have been brought challenging the provisions of the Patriot Act, which is the approach that I would take to the question. But there have been some significant cases brought. Very few have been resolved as of this time. The ACLU has filed an action recently challenging the provisions regarding national security letters that I was speaking about a moment before. In California, organizations have brought lawsuits challenging provisions of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which was actually signed into law by President Clinton, and that's the law that has the material support provisions in it, which are very problematic for a lot of groups involved in charity work and other eleemosynary organizations. And some provisions of that law, although very few, have been struck down by the courts, the federal courts in California. You know that Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla, well, not Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla, because they never even met the lawyers who were representing them, but lawyers on behalf of Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla, challenged the conditions of their confinement, and in certain respects, the United States Supreme Court said that although the president has the right to denominate people as enemy combatants, in all honesty, the ruling of the court with which I disagree, but the court said although the president has that right, those people who were denominated enemy combatants certainly have the right to have counsel, and there has to be some kind of proceeding before a neutral figure before they can continue to be held indefinitely. Now those proceedings are going forward now in Guantanamo. If you want to read about them, again on the Human Rights First website, there is a report from Deborah Perlstein, who went to Guantanamo along with representatives of three or four other human rights organizations and actually attended the preliminary hearings with regard to the Guantanamo detainees that were being charged with crimes under international law. And her report is very, very interesting reading. If we have time later in the question period, I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Thank you.
I'll give you the website in a minute. I think I've got some papers.
The third question is regarding non-terrorist use of the law. Some people are concerned that this act and related measures will be used to abridge their rights to protest. Please comment on this concern and address whether these provisions have been used for things other than counteracting terrorism. Mr. Abate?
It's good that people are concerned about that. And by the way, before I get onto it, as far as Mr. Hamdi, Mr. Padilla, Guantanamo, and unlawful combatants, none of those things have anything to do with the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act did not establish the situation in Guantanamo. The Patriot Act, all the law with regards to unlawful combatants in war and who is and isn't covered by the Geneva Convention existed for years prior to the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act didn't establish it, didn't change it. That's a completely separate issue, and if the Patriot Act were repealed tomorrow, Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla's situation would be exactly the same as what they are now. That just, by the way, nor does joining a union have anything to do with the Patriot Act. There are some things, valid concerns perhaps, and valid things for people to debate, but they do not have anything to do with the Patriot Act. As far as concerned about the act and related measures being used to abridge the rights of protest, it's something about which folks should be, as I used to say in previous activities, eternally vigilant. I spent a lot of my time, before I became a Fed, speaking out whenever I thought the federal government was mistaken in what it was doing. And the fact that the federal government hired someone like me means that the federal government isn't always looking to take over other people's lives because they need something to do, as opposed to trying to keep terrorists from attacking us, trying to keep drug dealers from committing crimes. And in terms of whether or not the act have been used for things other than counteracting terrorism, they haven't been used for that unless, as Professor Avery said, one of the things Professor Avery was accurate about is what the Patriot Act did is it took the FSA court, which again was established during the time of Soviet communism, and what used to be a situation where you'd have to go there and have something that dealt exclusively with foreign terrorism. If something is primarily foreign terrorism or has to do with foreign terrorism, again, in order to keep from delaying while they build a case, they can prove to a judge that it has something to do. If in the course of investigating terrorism, they discover drug dealing, or they discover organized crime, murder for hire, or what have you, then it'll be prosecuted, but not because the Patriot Act is used to go after something like that in the first instance. The other thing is a lot of the terrorist organizations that are pursued are not the same ones, if you will, as the 19 hijackers on September 11th belonged to. One of the recent uses of the Patriot Act was a group in Miami that was assembling firearms, essentially, for FARC. I don't know what the Spanish acronym is, but it's the cocaine cartel-associated terrorist group in Colombia. And so that was one of the uses. And people might think, well, that's drug dealing and not terrorism, but they are a federally designated terrorist organization, so they come under the ambit. And by the way, one of the things Professor rightly said is when you go into the FSA court, or when they go in, I've never been to it, I didn't know where it was, the defense lawyer isn't present when law enforcement applies for one of those search warrants. I've never heard of the defense lawyer being present ever when law enforcement applies for a search warrant. It doesn't happen in the Goffstown District Court, it doesn't happen in Hillsborough Superior Court, and it doesn't happen in Federal District Court in Concord. So that's nothing new, and it's nothing the Patriot Act established. The judges do that on their own. When they issue search warrants, they issue them without defense lawyers being present in all courts. Thank you.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the provisions, let me back up. First of all, I don't like to talk just about the Patriot Act. You've got that grip. But on the other hand, everywhere I've been, and I've been debating people from the Justice Department all the way from Alaska to Maryland about these issues, and everywhere I've been, the representative of the Justice Department wants to argue. I'm going to bet, I don't know if this is true, but I'm going to bet that a memo went out on this, wants to argue that various things that we bring up, I and ACLU lawyers and other NLG lawyers, aren't in the Patriot Act. Like that makes it okay. That's not my point of view. There's been a whole package of things that have been enacted since the Bush administration came into power, of which the Patriot Act is only one, but not the only one that we have to worry about. So I'm very worried about Guantanamo. I'm very worried about American soldiers torturing people at Abu Ghraib. I'm very worried about the enemy combatant provisions, which, by the way, the Bush administration did redefine how they were going to treat enemy combatants, did set aside the protections of the Geneva Conventions, did refuse to treat these people as prisoners of war and give them the protection of the Geneva Convention. That is what the Bush administration did. I'm not only interested in what the Patriot Act did, I'm interested in what the Bush administration has been doing. Now, second, with regard to the Patriot Act, focusing on that for just a minute, it's also true, and there are memos about this, and I'd be amazed if you didn't get them, instructing prosecutors, federal prosecutors, about how the anti-terrorism provisions of the Patriot Act can be used not only with regard to drug crimes, but also with regard to money laundering crimes, and with regard to fraud crimes, and with regard to other types of crimes. And there are seminars that are held at the Justice Department in Washington so that the prosecutors will learn how to make the full use of the provisions of this law, not just in terrorism cases, but in all kinds of cases. So this thing that was enacted supposedly as a response to terrorism, and by the way, the Patriot Act wasn't something that somebody dreamed up on September 12th. This is 538 pages or whatever it is. You think they drafted it and in the 4 weeks it took them to pass it? No, these were proposals that had been lying around, some of them for years, most of them discredited. This was the wish list of law enforcement in this country that got enacted under the USA, terms of the USA Patriot Act, and of course they use it in non-terrorism investigations. Thank you.
The next question, change of format, Mr. Avery will go first. On the impact of the 9/11 report, how might the recommendations from the 9/11 Commission impact our civil liberties?
I have to confess, I don't hold myself out as an expert on the 9/11 report, and I have very little to say about this. I've given this very little thought so far about whether the proposals to consolidate, investigations of foreign agents or terrorism under a single intelligence czar, as to whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, or how it will affect civil liberties. I do think that there is a trickle-down effect that I'm concerned about that goes back to the issue about terrorism generally. And that is that people begin to view it as part of everybody's responsibility. Indeed, we're all exhorted to do so, to report suspicious behavior to the authorities, as everybody's responsibility to become an agent for the government. And you know that originally Bush and Ashcroft wanted to have something called the TIPS program, which would have enlisted all the people in this country who were meter readers and telephone repair people and cable guys and so on and so forth to spy for the government. Remember, they saw anything suspicious in people's homes. Congress rejected that, but that's been reinvigorated, and if you read the new ACLU report, which you can get from their website, aclu.org, their new report about the surveillance industrial complex, you can see how the government is still recruiting individuals and businesses into their surveillance network. I'm concerned that the notion that what we need is an intelligence czar will further this what I call trickle-down effect of over-concern. You know, when I go, I don't go there very often because I don't shop at Neiman Marcus in the ordinary course, but when I go to the Copley Plaza Mall in Boston, and you drive into the Copley Plaza Mall, there's a guy there who looks in your trunk to see if you have a terrorist bomb in your trunk. I'm thinking if I'm working for Osama bin Laden, I'd probably have to go maybe once to figure out I didn't want to put the bomb in the trunk, but put it someplace else in the car. So this isn't real security, this is faux security. And I don't think, by the way, that the mall does this because Attorney General Ashcroft, much as I like to criticize Ashcroft, I don't think he called up the mall and said, you should be doing this. I think somebody at the mall said, this is a contribution we'll make to keeping America safe, right? And it's totally useless and totally an imposition and really silly. All it does is ratchet up the level of fear. And what I'm reflecting is that this is part of my concern about some of the proposals. But I have to apologize to you because I don't know enough about the detailed proposals to have what I call an expert opinion about their civil liberties implications.
I haven't been all over the country debating the Patriot Act. I haven't been to Alaska to do it. Candidly, I was subject to more than a little bit of trepidation that if I didn't do a very good job here tonight, I might be detailed to Alaska to argue with maybe permanently. And who knows? How might the recommendations from the 9/11 Commission impact our civil liberties? I'd say that's up to all of you, all of us, all of everyone's citizens, all of the citizens in the country. That's something that's still got to be decided. I, like the professor, am not really up on that. We came here to talk about the Patriot Act, and candidly, you know, it's perfectly appropriate in accordance with First Amendment rights, in accordance with good citizenship, to discuss what one thinks about Guantanamo, and discuss what one thinks about unlawful combatants. But it isn't part of the Patriot Act. And there may or may not be a memo, I saw a lot of stuff before I came here, but I don't need a memo to tell me that if the forum is on the Patriot Act, that's what I should prepare to come here to talk about. And if you're concerned about Guantanamo and you think what's happening there is not
in accord with the law is not appropriate. I happen not to think so. Or if you disagree with how unlawful combatants are treated and in accordance with the law since, I think, before World War II, well, that's appropriate, and that's something for you to think about, but it's not part of the Patriot Act. And if the Patriot Act were repealed tomorrow, it wouldn't change that. The other thing is, that I didn't come prepared to talk about, is we're not allowed to be involved in politics. So the claims that all this happened because of President Bush and all this happened because of Attorney General Ashcroft, I know I saw something, in fact, I think I saw a printout of the testimony of Senator Feinstein and Senator Biden, and memory doesn't fail me in the 2.5 years I've been a Fed. Before that, I believe they weren't strong allies of President Bush on all occasions. I'm quite sure I saw something from former Attorney General Reno saying, consistent with the professor's comments, that some of these provisions had been around since prior to the time those airplanes flew into the towers, knocked them down, and murdered 3,000 people, convincing folks that, sadly, the way the world is today, we need them. And that's why we've had them, and that's why they've worked for 3 years. It hasn't been this long. Thank you.
Start with Mr. Avery again. Describe the FISA court and national security letters, how they work, and what impact they have on the reach of executive powers.
Well, I think I talked about this a little bit already, so I won't repeat what I've said. And in fact, I'll just give a short answer, because we can then move on to something else. The difference between what the government can do with national security letters and what it can do under Section 211 of the Patriot Act, which allows them to get a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and get library records, for example. The difference between that and the subpoena power that the grand jury has is enormous. Because when you get a subpoena from a grand jury, which is the ordinary way the government gathers information in connection with criminal investigations, first of all, you can tell people that you've been subpoenaed by the grand jury. It's not a separate crime for you to fail to keep secret that you've been subpoenaed by the grand jury. So there's public ventilation. Of course, proceedings before the grand jury themselves are secret and always have been, up until the Patriot Act, which made some of them less secret by allowing law enforcement agencies to share that information with each other. But there's a little more ventilation of what's happened. Secondly, if my records are subpoenaed, certainly if they're subpoenaed from me, and even if they're subpoenaed from somebody that might tell me that my records are being subpoenaed, we can move to quash the subpoena and have some judge rule on whether or not those records are properly being sought. That's not true of national security letters, and it's not true of what happens under Section 211 when there's a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. So the problem is that we have much greater secrecy, much less judicial review, much less awareness by the population, and much less awareness by the person whose records are being viewed by the government.
What the professor said on this topic is largely accurate. There is much less secret. I think where we diverge is that there are those who believe that this power is not being used in good faith in front of the judge with probable cause, that there's genuinely a problem which justifies the utilization of that secrecy. At least in our office, there aren't a lot of people back-burnering folks who steal tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on credit cards with false IDs, valid passport fraud cases, armed robberies, things like that, because we need to high prioritize spying on the Quakers. And I don't think that's happening in the FISA courts either. And I don't think the judges would tolerate it if anyone tried it. Candidly, if there's anything like that going on, or if people aren't comfortable with the FISA courts, that's a framework that's essentially existed since the 70s. And while it is a valid framework on which to keep a close eye, because that kind of secrecy is a very, very serious thing, it is not a secrecy that's engaged in bad faith.
faith for any reason other than national security. Commonly, when those kinds of things are kept secret, it's because if they're not kept secret, the source of the information is going to be abducted and tortured to death, or for some other reason. The cable tap that went on the underground cable the Soviet Navy had during the Cold War. We're just finding out about it now, and that's part of why we won the Cold War. Is that type of thing unusual to keep it secret from the citizenry? Yes. Was it necessary if we were going to get the intelligence that came out of that cable? Yes, again. Did the people who have that power, federal prosecutors, military people, the judges, administrate it in good faith for 30 years, and are we still here because of it? Yes. Thank you.
Okay, one last question before we bring it to the audience. Summarize the changes you would make, if any, to the U.S. Patriot Act and related measures. Ms. David?
Summarize the changes I would make to the Patriot Act and related measures. I think we need to go back to first principles. Let's talk about secrecy for a moment. Certainly there's a need for secrecy sometimes in the context of a criminal investigation or an anti-terrorism investigation. But the government has gone far beyond that in terms of secrecy. We had gotten to a point with the Freedom of Information Act where we were moving more in the direction of having government in this country be transparent, of allowing people to find out about what our government is doing, and in the direction with some of the statutes I mentioned before of keeping information about individuals private. That's been reversed. One of the first things Attorney General Ashcroft did when he came into office was to send out a memorandum to all the agencies, all the federal agencies that have to respond to Freedom of Information Act requests, saying, we don't think we should be giving out all this information, and if you deny Freedom of Information Act requests, we're going to back you up. There's no question that the lawyers who do Freedom of Information Freedom of Information Act requests have been shut down under the Ashcroft Justice Department from finding out what the government is doing. So I would go back to the direction of saying, we want to know more about what our government is doing, and we want the government to know less about what we're doing. I would go back in the direction of saying, there are no free speech zones. All the streets and parks and sidewalks and open public spaces are free speech zones in this country. I would go back in the direction of saying, we're not a people who has to be afraid and live in fear and have our lives controlled by fear. If we live that way, as many people point out, the terrorists have been successful. We're terrorized. We're living like a people afraid of our own freedom. Have you gone down to Washington, D.C. lately and tried to walk by the White House and take a look at it? You can't get anywhere near it. Our public buildings are surrounded by concrete barriers. Government agents are surrounded by concrete cyber walls. I think we need to go back to first principles in this country, respect for the Constitution. I think that the government has completely failed to make the case that the Patriot Act was necessary, or that the other measures that Ashcroft and company have brought in are necessary. And I think that burden was on them to make that case. They have never made the case that they couldn't stop terrorism with the tools they had. Prosecutors like to say, oh, we couldn't share information with other agencies. That's not true. It was their own choice not to share information with other agencies. There was no federal law, there was no constitutional law that kept them from sharing information, certainly information regarding terrorism. In fact, one of the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission seems to be that 9/11 itself might have been able to have been prevented by the tools that were already in place. So I'm in favor of dismantling most of what's been enacted in the last 3 years, going back to first principles, standing on our constitutional rights, while doing just those things that are really necessary and really make sense to keep us safe. Thank you.
Summarize the changes you would make, if any, to the USA Patriot Act and related measures. Professor Avery proved that, like me, he's a lawyer, instead of saying, repeal it, thank you, and sitting down, he made it maybe even longer, which is probably what I would have done in his shoes. Candidly, I don't know, I didn't come prepared to answer the question as far as the changes I would make. I studied up on how it's been used, I studied up on how it exists, and again, a line AUSA in the District of New Hampshire who does mostly fraud work, I'm not sure is terrifically qualified to make recommendations. There was a mention of the President, and there was a mention of Attorney General Ashcroft. It wasn't them and their crew was the word. It was 98 senators versus one who enacted the Patriot Act, and 80-something percent of the people in the House of Representatives. President Bush's re-election campaign, I suppose, could debate some of these things better than I. That's not why I'm here. That's not why I'm allowed to be here. But candidly, again, I apologize. I don't personally have any viewpoint on what changes might or might not be made, and I'm not sure my views on those topics in my current job would matter. Thank you.
At this time, I would like to open up the discussion to the audience. I would like you to come to the center and line up here. Unfortunately, we don't have a microphone there, so we'll speak loudly and clearly. Was regarding the FISA court. Who is appointed? How are they appointed?
And the scope of their work. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe all the judges on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court are otherwise sitting federal judges who've been appointed as federal judges in the ordinary fashion, and then they're chosen from among the federal judges by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I think that's the mechanism.
Candidly, I don't know because, I had to learn the Patriot Act to come here and do this. First time I've ever done it. It's an excellent question. All I know about it is it's existed since the 70s, and I didn't study its existence or how it operates adequately. I know the Patriot Act sort of expanded its jurisdiction. Beyond the fact that it's existed since the 70s, I really don't know a great deal about it.
I'm pretty sure I'm right about that.
I think he probably is. But
chosen by Chief Justice Rehnquist. And the scope of their duties is determined by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, by the powers that are given to them by Congress when they enact the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And basically, it involves approving searches and electronic surveillance and things of that sort. Well, here's what happens. If there's a criminal case that results from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act wiretap or search, then there'll be limited oversight of the warrant in this respect. And I actually tried a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act case. I tried a case where there was a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance wiretap. When someone gets arrested and the government wants to introduce evidence that they seized as a result of surveillance, electronic surveillance, the defendant has a right to challenge whether the warrant was properly issued in the first place. And in an ordinary case, you get to see the affidavit that the government filed in support of the warrant. In a FISA case, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act case, the defense lawyers and the defendants never get to see the government's submissions in support of the warrant. All they know is there was a warrant, and it resulted in a search, and certain things were seized or observed. The judge in the criminal case reviews all that information in camera, in her chambers, without making any of it available to the defense lawyers. And she can, you know, she can issue a ruling that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court was wrong, which then could be appealed up to the Supreme Court. But the defense lawyers never really have a meaningful opportunity to argue.
Yes.
I want to thank you both for coming. And I'd like to thank Mr. Rubega for pointing out that both the Republican and Democratic bobbleheads in Congress have sold our constitutional rights down the river by voting for the Patriot Act.
Let the record reflect, I didn't put it that way.
The Patriot Act is designed to protect us from terrorism. I'd like to know why they haven't used their resources to investigate the millions of dollars of good options that were bought just before 9/11, using money to bet against certain airlines that were going to crash. Why the Ground Zero evidence was packed up and shipped out before any meaningful investigation was done as to the actual cause of those buildings collapsing. When I look at the video of those buildings collapsing, I see what looks to me like a precisely controlled implosion, the way they came down. I'd like to know more about it. And do you think that, talk about Mohammed Atta buying a telephone, but that some of the money that was sent from the U.S. to the Pakistani intelligence, and then sent back from Pakistani intelligence to Mohammed Atta, could have been used to buy that telephone.
With regards to the first question about
trading in the stock market, put options against airlines, put options against insurance companies, things like that. Actually, that, again, was my area of concentration in my legal practice back prior to the time I became a Fed, and I was, in fact, in private practice at that time. I wasn't privy to all of it, but I know the National Association of Securities Dealers, and I know the SEC did investigate some of that. I candidly don't recall whether Congress got in on that or didn't. And what I do recall about the investigations they did, they made a couple of very pointed, had some very pointed questions with some certain individuals. And my recollection of it was that while there were suspicions, certainly nothing was ever proven about anyone who benefited from trading in the market as a result of the drop in the market post 9/11. None of it was ever tied directly to terrorism, or could it ever be proven to have been tied directly to terrorism. It's certainly an excellent question, because there's the terrorists, and one of the things the Patriot Act has done that I didn't get a chance to mention or neglected to mention is it focuses in on certain activities in the financial services sector. They are very ingenious as to how they're raising money to finance their operations. The difference between terrorism and conventional organized crime is not only the fact that in terrorism there's no economic motive. You don't knock down the World Trade Center to make some money. You knock it down for political motives. But the other difference is it's organized crime writ large, because it's based on a lot of money. And one of the tremendous things the Patriot Act has done is it's increased the reach of the federal government into illicit financial transactions. I agree with everyone else that raised their hand saying the government shouldn't be able to spy on us whenever we go and bank. The government, and those of us who work for it, wouldn't have time to do that with regards to everybody if the government wanted to, which it doesn't. When the government's got probable cause to believe, or what looks like it might be probable cause to believe, there's some sort of illicit financial activity gone on tied to terrorism, they do their best to investigate it. And that particular investigation, as I recall, didn't pan out. But again, I wasn't a Fed then. I just know what I read from the newspapers. Second question was,
why was the Ground Zero cleaned up without proper investigation of the materials that were left over?
And again, before my time as a Fed, but my understanding is that it was a series of factors, not the least of which was a desire to accommodate the folks who basically wanted back bodies of their relatives, try and find it as fast as possible. And I never went there, but it was said to be a completely gargantuan task. I think the pile of rubble was something like six stories high or something. I think it was just impractical to do a more thorough job than what they did. And that being said, the job that was done was tremendously thorough, again, as I understand it. Third question, I apologize. Phil McCollum.
It was more of a statement.
Oh, okay. It was rhetorical, all right. I don't want to leave the rest of them waiting. When I was moderator, I'd make them stand in line to talk, so I'd pick out the hands, but this probably makes them talk.
No, no, it's all right.
You were commenting that the New York City police would be an egregious act if they arrested innocent people. Last Sunday, my son and daughter-in-law rode into New York City on a bicycle from Brooklyn. They wanted to see the demonstration was like, they never been able to go before. They found a safe spot by some gentlemen who were wearing these green legal hats, saying legal observers. Ahead of them, he started getting a bicycle, so they put each other's to leave the city, and they were immediately jumped on by the police and arrested. They were number 2, 3, and prisoners of 4 be arrested in the police station, along with 8 legal advisors. Now, my daughter-in-law is an elementary school teacher. She teaches second grade. Yesterday, she had to go to the New York City Department of Education to confess that she was arrested. Her job is definitely not alone. Now, my question to Mr. Levay is, since this was a false arrest by accusers of the New York City Police Department, your comment was that anybody who accuses somebody falsely shouldn't be held accountable. How is she to take her job and hold herself accountable? She's going to be fighting the New York City Police Department.
I would imagine the whole purpose for the folks in the green hats were to address precisely this kind of a situation. If, as you say, they were arrested with absolutely positively no reason or justifiable cause, well then, I'm sure that if there were attorneys there with green hats on watching it happen, they'll be able to address it.
But my son is actually in jail with 8 of them, including one of the Southampton case. Plus,